Best practice two, have the mettle to say no to requests and demands outside your chosen work-life balance plan. Eventually, most people come up with a work-life balance arrangement that works for them. The trick is sticking to it. That takes discipline. Saying no is hard, especially for business people who've gotten ahead precisely because they have said yes so often. I will always be impressed by Bill Woodburn, who was running GE's industrial diamond business in the late 1990s. We asked him to run a division several times that size, but he had the clarity about his priorities to say no, despite our efforts to persuade him. He had a daughter with 2 years to go in high school, and he just didn't want to uproot her. Today, Bill's daughter has long since graduated, and he's been promoted twice. He's now president and CEO of GE's infrastructure businesses. Usually, however, you don't need to say no to something as large as a promotion to get the balance you want. You just need to say it to smaller stuff. A request that you join yet another nonprofit board, a plea to coach yet another kid's sports team, and the like. If you say yes to everything, you won't get balance. You'll get off balance. Saying no is incredibly liberating. Try it on anything and everything that is not part of your deliberately chosen work-life plan. Best practice three. Make sure your work-life balance plan doesn't leave you out. A really killing dynamic in this work-life balance thing is the everyone's happy but me syndrome. Very competent people figure out a perfect work-life balance plan that allows them to deliver enough of themselves to the office, enough of themselves to home, and enough of themselves to one or two volunteer organizations. The problem is, this perfect plan creates a kind of fun-free vacuum for the person at its center. Of course, work-life balance involves making trade-offs, and decent people are obliged to deliver on their commitments to home and work. But if you craft a work-life balance plan while you are having no fun, chances are you won't be able to sustain it. You have to make sure your work-life balance plan fulfills your dreams and passions. If that means working a lot, do it. If that means being home every night, let that happen too. Yes, you have to be responsible to those around you, but you can't live someone else's concept of your life in the name of balance. Well, you can, but you shouldn't. It almost always backfires. We all know outwardly happy-looking people who juggle huge career and family demands only to suddenly stop and make drastic changes to their lives. They've just had enough of hanging on by their fingernails. One person we met recently at a cocktail party explained her decision to throw it in this way. I hadn't really had a good laugh for 15 years. I hadn't read the newspaper with a cup of coffee or played with a dog or called an old friend. It felt like every single minute I was struggling with logistics in order to meet everyone's needs but my own. Technically, I was a good enough wife and mother, and I was good enough at my job. Everyone else was okay, but I was miserable. I had to quit or I was going to collapse. Today, this woman works from home. Her family has less money, and she will tell you she misses her old life as a professional. But at least she can breathe and laugh. Work-life balance is not a decision you make alone. You have to confront how your choices affect a myriad of others. But if you don't fulfill your own joy with your plan, all the balance in the world is just duty. One day you'll wake up and find yourself in a special kind of hell where everyone is happy but you. And that doesn't do anyone any good. When you get right down to it, There are only a few things you need to know if you want to have it all. Outside of work, clarify what you want from life. At work, clarify what your boss wants. And understand that if you want to get ahead, what he or she wants comes first. You can eventually get what you both want, but the arrangement will be negotiated in that context. Make sure you work in a supportive culture where performance matters and you can earn flexibility chits with great results. Earn a lot of chits. Redeem as needed. Replenish often. Achieving work-life balance is a process. Getting it right is iterative. You get better at it with experience and observation. And eventually, after some time passes, you notice it's not getting harder anymore. It's just what you do. And now we come to the end of the book, tying up some loose ends. Back in the introduction, I said I was inspired to write this book by the questions I received traveling around the world over the past several years. Most of these questions, and my answers to them, ended up fitting into the 19 chapters preceding this one. A few questions, however, just couldn't be wedged into one topic area or another, be it leadership, hiring, change, strategy, or work-life balance. They were too broad, narrow, specific, or unusual. They just defied categorization. And yet these questions actually call to mind several of the themes that run through this book. The importance of candor and positive energy, for instance. The effectiveness of differentiation. The importance of voice. The power of authenticity and meritocracy. And the absolute necessity of change and never letting yourself be a victim. So I'm going to end this book with the questions that I call the ones that almost got away, hoping that they cover any territory I've missed and perhaps even remind you of some of the major signposts of the territory we've covered so far. This question was posed at a working dinner in Mexico City, attended by about 30 CEOs from various industries. It went like this. We spent the last 10 years bringing our company up to speed with training and process improvements. And with our low-cost labor, we were extremely competitive. But now we're getting killed by China. How can we stay alive? I've heard some form of this question everywhere, except China, of course. When I was in Dublin in 2001, for instance, a couple of months after Gateway announced it was closing up shop, an Irish technology executive anxiously asked, "Does this mean the end of the long boom for us?" In Milan in 2004, I spoke with a German manager who wondered if his company's only hope was to sell out to an Asian company that wanted his European distribution capability. At a conference in Chicago the same year, a machine parts manufacturer based in Cleveland described in agonizing detail how the Chinese kept lowering and lowering the price of their competing products. He asked, "Will there be any manufacturing left in Ohio?" There is no easy answer to the China question. Yes, you hear about China's problems, its scarcity of middle managers, for instance, and the massive number of poor farming families moving into unprepared cities with not enough jobs to support them. Lumbering, bureaucratic state-owned enterprises still make up most of its economy. And the country's banks are saddled with bad loans. But for China, these aren't mountains to be scaled. They're blips to be flattened by the giant high-speed bulldozer that is its economy. Increasing prosperity from spectacular economic growth over the past 20 years has given the Chinese enormous self-confidence. But China has so much more. A massive pool of low-cost, hard-working laborers and a rapidly expanding number of well-educated engineers. And then there's its work ethic, which may be its single biggest strength. Entrepreneurship and competition are baked into the Chinese culture. Consider the executive who hosted me during a week-long visit to Shanghai and Beijing last year. She says she's at the office from 7 a.m. until 6 p.m., goes home to dinner to join her husband and son until 8 p.m., and then returns to work until midnight. This is very typical here, she said, 6 days a week. And she works for a U.S. multinational. So faced with the inevitability of China, what do you do? First and foremost, get out of the tank. The sense of bleakness that I heard from Mexico to Milan and across the United States is perhaps understandable, but it doesn't get you anywhere. It's not as if the developed economies of the world are in shambles. The developed world has large consumer and industrial markets, all thirsting for products, with great brands and distribution mechanisms to serve them. Its economies have open and mature legal systems. They are transparent societies with democratic governments and good education and social systems. Its businesses have fully developed management processes. The United States has the added advantage of a large, thriving venture capital market with the capability to provide seed capital for just about any good idea. The list of the developed world's competitive advantages could go on and on. So think positively. At the very least, a can-do attitude is a place to start. Remember my description of the Japanese threat in the early 80s? At times, it felt like we were dying, and everyone seemed to agree. Journalists and political pundits predicted the imminent demise of industrial companies like GE, and you couldn't blame them, given the circumstances. Inflation was double-digit, and the prime rate peaked at more than 20%. In Syracuse, we were making TV sets that cost more coming out of the factory than the Japanese were selling them for in a mall less than 2 miles away. It sure felt like the worst of times. But that's the point, really. In the heat of battle, it always feels like the worst of times. Low-cost competitors are not new. Hong Kong and Taiwan have been in the game for over 40 years. And Mexico, the Philippines, India, and Eastern Europe have been a factor for some time. Even in the late 90s, when the wind was at everyone's back and making money was easier than it had been in decades, work felt really hard. Big companies were labeled dinosaurs, and it became conventional wisdom that technology startups would soon rule the world. In fact, it was said whole industries were going to be obliterated by the internet. Then the bubble burst. Many of those little companies that were going to rule the world disappeared. Others like eBay and Amazon not only survived, they thrived. But so did the so-called dinosaurs, because they changed. They grabbed the new technology and transformed themselves, emerging stronger than ever. And change is what China demands of us now. How? First and foremost, bring out the three old war horses of competition, cost, quality, and service, and drive them to new levels, making every person in the organization see them for what they are, a matter of survival. Take costs. Everyone needs to be searching everywhere, inside the company and out, for best practices. Hard calls need to be made about where and how every single process should be performed to ratchet up productivity. Don't think about reducing costs by 5 to 10%. You have to find the ways to take out 30 to 40%. In most cases, that's what it's going to take to be competitive in the China world. On quality, you just can't have a ship-and-fix mentality. Getting it right 95% of the time is not good enough. Use Six Sigma or any methodology you like, but get rid of defects. Service is the easiest advantage to exploit. China is thousands of miles away from most developed markets. Remember Gary Drug, the tiny pharmacy in our neighborhood, where not only do they know your name, they deliver it to your house within an hour? It's standing strong against its China, the big, shiny chain store pharmacy three blocks away. And think about the Mexican CEO who asked this question to start with. His country's proximity to the United States gives it a huge advantage in response time. Again, your challenge is not just to improve. It's to break the service paradigm in your industry or market so that customers aren't satisfied. They're so shocked that they tell strangers on the street how good you are. FedEx and Dell come to mind as examples of this. While you have to innovate to improve cost, quality, and service, go beyond that. Take a new, hard look at your market. Search out untapped opportunities. Find new niches. Just don't keep pounding out the same stuff. That market you're serving may seem saturated, but it's filled with plenty of demand for exciting new products, services, or technologies. That's what Procter & Gamble discovered recently. There was no company more set in its ways than P&G. But in less than 5 years, the company instilled a whole new vigor into its innovation efforts. It broke its NIH syndrome and scoured every corner of the world for garage inventors with cutting-edge ideas. And they didn't stop there. The search for new ideas led them to create networks into other companies, suppliers, universities, research labs, and venture capitalists. They took some of the ideas they found and fine-tuned them, and used others to reinvent existing products. For instance, P&G took the tried-and-true electrostatic technology used to paint cars and applied it to its cosmetics business, transforming the way its makeup products go on the skin. With a new can-do attitude, the company also revitalized in-house R&D. The result was products like Crest White Strips and the Swiffer cleaning products, which literally invented whole new mass-market categories. And finally, while you're innovating and searching for new products, markets, and niches, come to terms with the fact that China can be much more than a competitor. Think of China as a market, an outsourcing option, and a potential partner. Unlike Japan in its early development, China's huge market is relatively open to direct investment. Many can go it alone there, ideally selling their product in the Chinese market while sourcing product for their home market. Alternatively, you can join forces with a local business. Needless to say, Chinese joint ventures aren't easy. In my experience, to make them happen, you have to make sure the Chinese partner feels as if it has gained a lot, perhaps more than you. But there are ways to craft win-win deals. When GE Medical formed a joint venture in 1991, its Chinese partner brought great local market know-how. That was a big factor in the company's achieving the number one market share in imported GE high-end imaging products. At the same time, the joint venture's Chinese engineers designed and built low-cost, high-quality products that were exported through GE's global distribution network. Now, I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna about China. Its presence is a real game-changer in business today. And even if trade restrictions get enacted, its currency is allowed to fluctuate, and intellectual property laws are passed, no political solution in the world is going to make it go away. But China is a classic case of the glass half empty or half full, isn't it? You can look at the situation and feel victimized, or you can look at it and be excited about conquering the challenges and opportunities it presents. Now pick the latter. You just can't win wringing your hands. This question was posed by an audience member in London at a conference attended by about 3,000 middle and senior managers. The question went like this. Norway has just passed a law mandating that half of every corporate board be comprised of women. What is your opinion on that? My answer? It's ridiculous. Obviously, I'm not against women directors. They've made major contributions to thousands of boards around the world. In fact, one of the best directors I've ever known is a woman who served on the GE board, Gigi Michelson, the former director of human resources at R.H. Macy and head of Columbia University's Board of Trustees, whose people insights and general wisdom guided me for two decades. Nevertheless, I just don't like quotas, in the boardroom or in the office. Winning companies are meritocracies. They practice differentiation, making a clear distinction between top, middle, and bottom performance. The system is candid and fair, and it's the most effective way for an organization to field the best team. Quotas undermine meritocracies. They artificially push some people ahead, independent of qualifications. That can be demotivating to the top performers who are passed over. And it doesn't do much for results either, when unprepared people are thrust into important jobs. Okay then, so what does work? Return for a minute to the Getting Promoted chapter. Its advice is color and gender blind. If you want to get promoted, your best bet is to over-deliver on your results, manage your subordinates as carefully as you manage your boss, get on the radar screen by supporting major initiatives early, relish the input of lots of mentors, and always have a positive, high-energy approach to life and work. At the same time, don't make your boss use his political capital to champion you. And when setbacks occur, and they will, don't let them break your stride. I'm not saying women and minorities haven't had a tough go of it in the business world. They have, and they do need mechanisms to give them a higher profile in the system. One such mechanism is diversity groups, like GE's Women's Network or its African American Forum. These groups have created an opportunity for successful women and minority executives to serve as role models. Just as important, they provide a setting to talk about the ways women and minorities can increase their experience and skills, and thus their visibility in an organization. They promote the concept that success is a function of talent, energy, and drive, just as meritocracies are. But the whole subject of diversity is more nuanced and complicated than I am making it out to be. At GE, the African American Forum was a grassroots effort that started in 1990. It was bumping along without a lot of momentum until the senior vice president, Lloyd Trotter, grabbed it by the neck and gave it a whole new energy with seminars, conferences, and mentoring programs. With Lloyd in charge, every African-American in the company wanted to get on board, and all of Lloyd's peers wanted to jump in to help. The group really took off, and in time, so did promotions for African-Americans. On the other hand, in the mid-90s, I would have dinners twice a year with high-potential women, where we would discuss the work-life issues they were facing. In 1997, after a long give and take, I challenged the group to create their own version of the African American Forum. They seemed enthusiastic, but much to my surprise, over the next few weeks, I found that some of our top women were balking at the idea. They felt they had made it without any label. They didn't want to be thought of as successful women. They wanted to be thought of as successful executives. After a couple of years, much of that faded, as even the most reluctant grew to enjoy their mentoring and its positive impact on the progress of women in the company. Back to the quota question about Norway. The only quota that I ever thought worked was the exposure quota we used at GE. That is, we made sure there was a woman or minority candidate on every slate for the top 2,000 jobs. That guaranteed every manager saw the diverse candidates out there and that diverse candidates had a shot. I spent the first half of my tenure as CEO focused on changing the portfolio and competitiveness. Diversity for me didn't come into play until the 90s. But today, if you want to field the best team, you simply can't afford a delay. I've received this question numerous times from audiences from New York to Sydney. How did you pick your successor, Jeff Immelt, and how do you think he's doing so far? I'm always thrilled to answer the second part of this question. It's such a layup. Jeff is doing amazingly well, even exceeding my expectations for his leadership. I couldn't be more proud of where he has taken GE and where it is going. Jeff became chairman and CEO of GE on September 10, 2001. So it was technically his second day on the job when the terrorist attacks changed the game for everyone. Jeff handled the new uncertainty of the business environment with characteristic thoughtfulness and determination. Despite the resulting downturns in the airline, power, and reinsurance industries, he masterfully navigated the company to modest annual earnings growth from 2001 until 2004. At the same time, Jeff made significant changes to the portfolio that positioned GE for future growth. He made major media, medical, financial services, and infrastructure acquisitions while disposing of slower growth, industrial, and insurance assets. He reinvigorated GE's research and development activities with large facilities investments in Munich, Shanghai, and Schenectady, New York. And Jeff has put enormous emphasis on diversity at GE with immediate and positive results. Several times in this book, I've said that change is good. Jeff sure proves that point. As for how and why I picked Jeff, I just don't ever talk about that. There were three terrific people to choose from: Jeff, Bob Nardelli, and Jim McNerney. There is no reason to conduct the public autopsy on the process. It's past. Both Jim and Bob have gone on to spectacular runs in their new roles. Bob as CEO of the Home Depot and Jim at 3M. What I will say is at the end of the day, the board and I picked whom we believe to be the best leader for GE. And Jeff is making us all look very good. This question was posed at a management conference in Reykjavik, Iceland, and during a 12-person dinner in London. What's the future of the European Union? My answer, long-term, it's very good. With all the sound and fury about China, some people see the EU as a huge lumbering bureaucracy that will never get its collective act together fast enough to reach its full potential in the global economy. Maybe that's true in the short run, but in time, the EU will prove naysayers wrong. Remember, the economic EU is less than 15 years old. It's already come a long way. Imagine trying to put together the 50 states of the United States today. Now imagine doing that if each state had operated for centuries with a separate government, set of laws, language, currency, and culture, as the members of the EU have. That the EU has done so well in so short a time is actually sort of amazing. Without question, the EU still has a long way to go before it realizes the economic hopes and dreams of its supporters. But its current statistics are enough to give you a sense of the potential to be unleashed. With 25 countries, the EU has 450 million people, 50% more than the United States, and a GDP of $11 trillion, about the same as the United States, 2.5 times Japan, and about 7 times China. These numbers are impressive, but they'll only get better as the EU feels the impact of its newest members, Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, the Czech Republic, and the other nations of New Europe. In the past decade, from Budapest to Bratislava, from Prague to Warsaw, I've seen the excitement, optimism, and the remarkable achievements in these countries. A new generation of entrepreneurs and small business people are thirsting for opportunity and success. Their governments have responded in kind, reducing taxes and providing other pro-business incentives. The result has been significant economic growth, especially in comparison to what's going on in old Europe. Yes, old Europe has problems and a long history. Brussels is filled with bureaucrats, and the individual governments of many countries are fighting tooth and nail to hang on to their hard-earned sovereignty. With their entrenched cultural traditions, France and Germany in particular are lukewarm about the EU and often act with blatant self-interest. But these problems are not insurmountable. Washington, Tokyo, and Beijing have plenty of bureaucrats too. And as new generations of political leaders emerge across Europe, and the leadership of the EU itself gains increasing stature with every passing year, the pull of parochial, old economic order governments will give way. For example, the French government recently began to ease its rigid support of the 33-hour work week and is now proposing that companies be allowed to negotiate directly with employees about work schedules. In time, and perhaps sooner than many expect, global competitive pressures and the energy of New Europe will have a powerful combined effect. The paralyzing weight of socialism will gradually give way, and the EU will move steadily forward, fueled by an ever-increasing acceptance of capitalism. This question came at a technology and innovation conference in Las Vegas that spanned 3 days and featured about 20 speakers. I was one of them. How do you think corporate boards will change because of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act? This question, which I heard in various forms and in many locations, including Australia and Europe, reflects a growing attention on governance, a topic for discussion that used to be reserved for shareholder meetings and business school classrooms. Then, of course, came the post-bubble corporate scandals, and people began to ask, where the heck were the boards in all these messes? Why didn't they see the funny business? Very quickly, laws and regulations were passed to make boards and senior executives more accountable for any corruption that might occur on their watch. In general, these rules, such as the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, are a good thing, necessary to restore economic confidence. But laws will never guarantee good corporate governance. There is no way that a board's finance committee, comprised of a finance professor, an accountant, and several busy CEOs, all from far-flung locations, can spend a couple of days every month studying a company's books and verify that everything is on the up and up. Imagine being a board member of a multinational bank. You have people trading everything, swapping Japanese yen for euros in London, and others betting on U.S. commodity futures down the hall. But even most small companies have too much complexity for a committee to track, with hundreds of transactions every day, near and far. While boards cannot be policemen, they must assure themselves that companies have auditors, rigorous internal processes, tight controls, and the right culture for that purpose. Boards play other roles as well. They pick the CEO and approve the top management. In fact, they should know the members of the top team as well as their own colleagues. Boards also monitor the mission of a company. Is it real? Do people understand it? Is it being executed? Can it win? Boards also gauge the integrity of the company. That's huge. They must visit field operations and conduct meaningful conversations with people at every level, eyeball to eyeball. It is in this subtle, nuanced integrity watchdog role that boards can make a real contribution. For some boards now, Sarbanes-Oxley will require a real change in behavior. They'll need to stop thinking about their jobs as 8, 10, or 12 closed-door meetings a year with lovely catered lunches. For others, it'll only reinforce their existing approach. Now, in the rush to deal with scandals, perhaps some aspects of Sarbanes-Oxley went too far. For example, the rules that imply the superiority of independent directors over directors who have some sort of stake in the company, either as investors, suppliers, or any other form of business partner. This new requirement needs a relook with a big dose of common sense. There's nothing wrong with directors having skin in the game. For the shareholder's sake, directors should really care about how the company is doing. But the notion that independent directors are better for the company is having the unintended consequence, in some cases, of removing good judgment and experience from where it is needed most. Take the case of Sam Nunn, the distinguished former U.S. Senator from Georgia, or Roger Penske, the automobile industry entrepreneur. Both were required to leave GE board committees. Why? After leaving the Senate, Sam joined King & Spalding, a law firm that GE had done business with for decades. In Roger's case, he had a minority interest in a small GE truck leasing joint venture. Or take the case of Warren Buffett. Activists wanted him off the audit committee at Coca-Cola because of his large ownership stake. Who would represent the shareholders better on key committees than these three people? A professor? An accounting expert? The head of a charitable foundation? Why would shareholders ever want company executives answering to people who might need a director's salary to make ends meet? Those kinds of directors are less likely to challenge anything. They're more likely to duck tough issues in the hope they'll get reappointed. Now, let's not forget in all this conversation that boards exist to support and guide, as well as challenge management. It would be unfortunate indeed if Sarbanes-Oxley ends up making boards primarily adversarial in their approach. Board members can never forget their main job is to make the company work better, not to get into an us-versus-them dynamic with the very people they are supposed to help. In the final analysis, the best directors share four simple traits: good character, common sense, sound judgment, particularly about people, and the courage to speak up. Laws are all well and good, but it is people, culture, processes, controls, and strong directors that ultimately put compliance in a company's blood. This next question came at a breakfast meeting in Copenhagen with about 30 European managers doing business for their global companies in Scandinavia. The question went like this: I'm about to be transferred to run our operations in West Africa, and I've been told to expect that 40% of my workforce have AIDS or a family member suffering with the disease. Any suggestions for dealing with this problem? No question ever floored me like this one. And as if it wasn't disturbing enough on its own, another person at the breakfast, an executive from a consumer goods company, spoke up right afterward. "I'm just back from my operations in Africa," he said. "Try closer to 60%. What can a leader do in such a dire situation? What can a company do? It is in confronting a societal problem that the results of a winning company and a good culture really come together to make a difference. At the outset of this book, I tried to make the case that winning is great because it inspires people to be happy, creative, and generous. That was me talking from 20,000 feet. This question brings you right into the trenches. The manager who asked this question worked for a highly profitable oil company, and I could feel that he really wanted to do something. He'll be able to because his company is winning. He can launch programs to educate the workforce about AIDS. He can provide medical facilities and subsidize the expensive drugs the disease requires. He can really improve the lives of hundreds of people. And I'll bet he does. Winning companies help all the time. There are more than 50,000 active volunteers among GE's employees, involved in 4,000 projects a year, from mentoring in schools around the world to participating in countless other programs for the disadvantaged. Because of the efforts of GE volunteers, there have been amazing community projects in Hungarian towns, Jakarta slums, and inner-city schools in Cincinnati. Not only were these projects great for the people who were helped, they were equally beneficial for the people doing the helping. Their volunteering in the streets gave their work at the office more meaning and vitality. In Slovakia, Krishna Veta showed up in 2002 to manage U.S. Steel's newly acquired 16,000-employee plant in Kosice, a city with 23% unemployment in the impoverished eastern region of the country. Chris and his team took a real relic of communism, a money-losing state-owned enterprise, and with a $600 million investment, turned it into a highly profitable operation. While they were doing that, they poured time and money into Kosice. The list of their contributions is too long to mention here, but it includes building an oncology wing at the local children's hospital, remodeling primary school classrooms and providing them with computers, and refurbishing several orphanages and a facility for the blind. Consider also the outpouring of support from businesses around the world after the tragic Christmas tsunami of 2004. In a matter of days, companies and their people donated billions of dollars in cash and supplies to help people in ravaged communities. It was generosity of the highest order. I'm not talking here about motherhood and apple pie, or trying to sound like the typical annual report. This is how good business really works. Winning companies give back, and everyone wins. This question came from the reporter who moderated my Q&A session at a management conference for about 3,000 people in London. The question was, "Do you plan to enter politics?" In a word, my answer was never. It's not that I don't appreciate government. We're all grateful to public servants who've made national security and the eradication of terrorism their life work. On top of that, government provides other services that are vital to a thriving society. Schools, hospitals, and police, to name just three. But government, for all the good it does, is filled with all the problems that business has. But nobody seems to have the latitude to fix them. Basically, government is riddled with bureaucracy, waste, and inefficiency. In a company, you can clean those up, and you have to. In government, they're forever. Why? For one, because it's difficult to move people up or out based on merit. Most government agencies have no differentiation to speak of. You can work for 40 years, never excel or make a dent in results, and still get an annual raise. For another, you just cannot speak or act candidly in government without getting nailed. It's a world filled with compromise, patronage, and quid pro quo. Yes, all these behaviors exist in business, but managers can rally against them on their own or join a company that does so as a matter of course. Finally, governments can afford to be bureaucratic because they don't compete. During the last election season, the governor of Indiana created a big hoopla around the fact that he was going to withdraw the state from an outsourcing project that one of its departments had started in India. There was much cheering him on as a model of patriotism. It had to make you laugh. It was easy for the governor of Indiana to withdraw from India. In the public sector, you don't have to provide the highest value products or find the lowest cost solutions in order to create revenue. You can just keep raising taxes to pay for everything. So as important as government is, it's just not for me. This book makes the point that it's always better to do something you love. I've taken my own advice on this one. I've received this question everywhere. How's your golf game? Wow, do people love golf? Everywhere I go, perhaps because I stuck a chapter on golf in my last book, people ask about my handicap and whether it's improved since I retired. The answer is, I don't play anymore. And believe it or not, I don't miss it all that much. My obsession with golf lasted almost 60 years. From my first days playing and caddying at age 10 until my first back operation in 2002. I've had two more back operations since then, and thankfully, my back is better now. But I'm sure not inclined to test that proposition with a golf swing. If you've had back problems, you probably understand where I'm coming from. But in the absence of golf, a whole world of new interests has opened up to me. You can't believe how much time is available when you're not on the golf course all the time. I've loved consulting with several companies and their CEOs. I've also found I'm crazy about modern art, and I'm getting to live out my lifelong devotion to the Red Sox by attending as many home games as I can. I've been able to travel around the world with my wife and four stepchildren, and enjoy the sights beyond the conference rooms and factories, and been able to meet the many interesting people whose questions grew into this book. I have always loved new stuff. Looking forward, learning, and growing have always felt good to me. Golf was wonderful. It gave me great friends that I've enjoyed for decades and always will, and all the fun of competing. But when you can't play, you can't play. And amazingly, the world doesn't even end. And finally, this question was posed by an audience member at a management conference in Frankfurt, attended by about 2,500 people. Do you think you will go to heaven? After a few seconds of stunned silence, my first answer to this one was, well, I sure hope that's long-range planning. But after the audience stopped laughing, they were as surprised by the question as I was. The man who asked this question made it clear that he wanted to understand what I considered my legacy. First off, I hate the word legacy. It just sounds so arrogant. Presidents and prime ministers have legacies. I ran a company and wrote a book or two. But here we are at the end of this book, and the question did get asked, so I'll attempt an answer. If there is anything I would like to be remembered for, it is that I help people understand that leadership is all about helping other people grow and succeed. To repeat myself, leadership is not just about you, it's about them. I would also like to be remembered as a huge advocate of candor and meritocracy, and believing everyone deserves a chance. And I'd like to be remembered for trying to make the case that you can never let yourself be a victim. Now, it's no secret that I've made plenty of mistakes in my career. I've made some bad acquisitions, hired some wrong people, and moved too slowly in some opportunities. And that is just a fraction of the list. As for my personal life, I have 4 great children and 9 terrific grandchildren. My love and admiration for them cannot be expressed with words, and their happy, fulfilling lives today give me no end of pleasure. I had 2 marriages, however, that did not work out. Life goes on, and usually for the better. But no one lives through a divorce, or 2, and feels proud that it happened. So as for heaven, who knows? I'm sure not perfect, but if there are any points given out for caring about people with every fiber of your being and giving life all you've got every day, then I suppose I have a shot. Given the choice, of course, I'd rather not find out anytime soon. There's so much more to do. Let me acknowledge many of the people who helped me with this book. Business is about people. In fact, life is only people. Family, friends, colleagues, bosses, teachers, coaches, and neighbors. At the end of the day, it is only people that matter. People made this book. First, there were the thousands of men and women around the world who, as my dedication says, cared about business enough to raise their hands and ask the questions that fill these pages. I thank them for candidly sharing their stories, talking openly about the ever-changing challenges of work, and for helping me codify my thinking about how to get it right. I'm also grateful to the people who took an hour or two, and often more, to talk with me about their experiences so that the ideas in this book could be filled with life. Bill Harrison and Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase, Steve Klimkowski of Northwestern Memorial Healthcare, George Tamke, a partner at Clayton, Dubilier & Rice, David Novak, who runs Yum Brands, Bob Nardelli of The Home Depot, Robert Bagby of A.G. Edwards, Perry Ruddick, the retired vice chairman of Smith Barney, Maxine McHugh of the Australian Broadcasting Company, Kevin Scherer of Amgen, Jimmy Dunn of Sandler O'Neill & Partners, my old friend Paolo Fresco, former vice chairman of GE and retired CEO of Fiat, Jerry Roach of Heidrick & Struggles, Joel Klein, chancellor of the New York City Public School Systems, Jim McNerney of 3M, Paolo Monferino of Case New Holland, Dara Khosrowshahi of Expedia, and Chris Navetta of U.S. Steel. And from GE, Bill Connolly, Gary Reiner, Susan Peters, Dennis Dammerman, Mark Little, John Krenicki, and Charlene Begley. Bob Nelson, my financial analyst at GE for many years, was a very valuable reader along the way. Several people don't appear by name in this book, but their ideas were critical in shaping its content. Linda Gosden Robinson, president of Robinson, Lair & Montgomery, shared her considerable experience with us for the chapter on crisis management. For the chapter on work-life balance, I'm indebted to Professor Stu Friedman of the Wharton School and Claudio Fernandez of the executive search firm of Egon Zehnder. The chapter on mergers and acquisitions was helped by a long, insightful conversation with M&A expert David Fubini of McKinsey & Company. And my tiny newfound knowledge of philosophy is totally thanks to the insights of Nancy Bauer, professor at Tufts University. This book started with 2 pages of scribble notes about what it could be. The finished product in your hands is thanks to a stellar group of people, most notably the 4 E's and a P people at HarperCollins. Our wonderful editor, Leo Sparrow, whose probing mind and passion for this book never ebbed. Jane Friedman, a fervent believer from the get-go. And Marion Manica, whose deep wisdom guided us all the way. We're also grateful to the terrific team that marketed this book. Brian Murray, Joe Tessitore, Steve Hanselman, Paul Osluski, Keith Pfeffer, and Larry Hughes. The book's designer, Leah Carlson Stanisic, and its copy editor, Ann Greenberg. Our agent, Helen Reese, was a dear friend and enthusiastic supporter, and Megan Lamont did tenacious duty as our fact checker. My assistant, Roseanne Badowski, read every draft of this book, challenged the content, picked apart the phrases, and made every chapter better. Her caring and attention were remarkable, and I thank her for the endless hours she gave this project. Finally, there aren't enough words to thank my wife, Susie, for the job she did on this book. Her relentless questioning pulled out of me every idea I ever had about business, and her ability to organize and rephrase my, in many cases, random observations made this book so much better than I ever dreamed it could be. I always tell people that Susie is just about the smartest person I have ever met. And during the last year of writing this book, she has proved it and then some. For every chapter in this book, Susie wrote and rewrote countless drafts. And yet she never took a break from being an amazing mother to her 4 great kids. Every day, she astonishes me. For the last year, we have had the greatest time, day and night, debating and discussing all the material that went into this book. The conversation never stopped. As I travel the world, meeting people, answering questions, and asking plenty of my own, Susie was by my side, listening, analyzing, and opening my mind to what I knew and what more I could know. It was hard work and pure joy. Susie, you made it happen. Jack Welch, Boston, February 2005. And now for a conversation I had with Jane Friedman.
I'm Jane Friedman, President and CEO of HarperCollins Worldwide. And right now, I have just finished reading Winning by Jack Welch with Susie Welch. And I have gone through this manuscript, and I have underlined and underlined and underlined. And I am a CEO, and I'm learning all about how to be a better CEO from reading Winning. The first question I have for Jack is, why Winning now? And how did it come to be, and how did you work with your co-writer, Susie Welch?
Well, let me start with the first one. We were out on the road giving Q&A sessions at a variety of different locations, sometimes to 300 people, sometimes to 5,000. And the questions were incredible. People were constantly asking me the real hard, nitty-gritty business questions. And it was during the time of some of the crises here, the global scandals. And people had a down view of business. And Winning wasn't a very good thought at the time. And I really felt that the millions of people that are out there working in the right way, in the right time, needed to have their questions answered best I could do it. And it was time for a book that said why winning is good and why winning is the fundamental roadblock of building people's lives and how business is the engine of a society. And I try to make the case for that in here. As for working with my wife, that was a really great treat. I mean, it was also the first year of our marriage, which is always people laugh and say, how could you do that in your first year? Anyway, it was an incredible experience. We would talk for a week or so about a chapter. She would drag stories out of me that I had forgotten years back. She's a great editor and great writer, and she just kept pulling and pulling. And then after she got enough, she'd go sit down and write a first draft of a chapter. And that began a process. And we had second drafts and third drafts and fourth drafts and fifth drafts, sometimes 20th drafts between the two of us, picking away, trying to get a concise story to answer the questions that people had asked us.
Did you fight?
No, it's amazing. And people will never believe that story. Did we hold our ground on certain positions? Yes. Did we take words seriously? Yes. She more than I did. But we, in the end, did not have what I would call a real fight.
Is honesty always the best policy?
Well, I'm not talking so much about honesty. I'm talking about here about telling it like it is, seeing a business situation as it is. A lot of time is wasted, Jane, with people not wanting to face into reality, not wanting to deal with issues as they are, not wanting to confront weak colleagues, not wanting to reward strong colleagues for the fear of hurting the feelings of weak colleagues. So there's a lot of things where candor could just speed the whole process up. Look, we got a bad situation. Let's dig in and deal with it. And Joe and Mary aren't going to help us. Let's not use them. Let's get it done. I'm often with groups, and they're shocked by the fact that within each other, they all agree that they know the answer. Everyone's afraid to say it for the fear of impacting others, looking foolish, any number of things. But getting it all on the table is a big deal.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I do believe that when the millions of people read Winning and take it to heart, that candor is going to help all of us as CEOs. It is absolutely essential. But one of the other things that really surprised me, although I now understand it completely, is when you say that you believe the head of human resources is as important as the CFO. Those are big words.
Yeah, but I lived them. I lived them for 20 years as CEO, and I saw there isn't a CFO in the company that I work for that wouldn't consider his peer as HR manager equal to him in the organization. And there isn't an HR person that even thinks the CFO is close, probably. But look, if winning is about fielding the best team, getting the best players on the field, the best talent, the best writers for you, the best editors for you, the best musicians in an orchestra. You need help as a CEO, as a leader, as a manager. You want another input, and you want somebody to feel. The guy counting the score, you know, how many tickets were sold is important. But nobody's going to come if the players aren't any good. And so the HR person gets the right players on the field.
Don't you think that the fact that for so many years HR was called personnel, that may be why it's taking the HR director a little bit more time to get up to speed, that somehow it had a diminished role, but now it certainly is one of the top positions in the company? There's an anomaly there of what personnel was, and now human resources is.
Well, I think there's a little bit of that, but I think also personnel or HR as a training ground and a straight-up place is not a great place. I mean, mm-hmm. You're doing the picnics and you're doing the company newspaper and you're organizing the parties. I think that, for example, if I were in HarperCollins, I would take one of the most respected editors, writers, who had savvy, who could see around corners, who could, in fact, smell a phony a mile away. And I'd put that person, man or woman, right next to me as HR person. The organization would say, holy cow, Jane Friedman means it. She's brought so-and-so, who's the best at this, to do this. So you got to change the whole perception, because the perceptions in organizations have HR at such a low level. I'm not talking just CEOs. I'm talking about the people that run divisions in HarperCollins. They have an HR person. They've got to take somebody that's a star. Fellow in GE that was running HR for me was a plant manager. He had seen it all, negotiated with unions, done everything. He was a street guy. He knew everything.
Makes such good sense, such good sense. The other thing that makes such good sense, as we are about to go into our own budgeting process, is what is this? You talk about in Winning how you can really just eliminate so much wasted time, effort, charts, everything else. And just for the CEO to know what he or she wants, the division head to know what he or she wants, and to come in, have a realistic position, and go out 10 minutes later and say, let's do it.
Well, I think the issue is this. There's this crazy ritual where it starts months ahead of time at the bottom with poor souls bubbling up numbers and putting them all together and getting this book together with one objective, to come up with a low number to present to the next level, because for years we've made it clear that if you missed your number, you got punished. If you made your number, you were a hero. So there's a big exercise in minimalization, I call it. How little can we get away with? How little can we sell? Now, think of how different the dynamics of a meeting are. When you both come in and say, here's what I think I can do, but I need all these resources. Then you're arguing about making an acquisition, giving them more salespeople, giving them more advertising money. And you can make those calls, but you're all talking about growing the business bigger. It's a much better conversation. You end up with the same number. You end up with the same place, but the dialogue is so much different. Instead of me trying to convince you how little I can do, I'm trying to sell you on, give me some resources to let me take my HarperCollins division to a level it's never seen before. The conversation is 180 from what it normally is. In the phony budgeting process where the lights go out and the slides go up, and the teams negotiate, and at the end, one team says you can give me 10, another team says you can give me 6, and you end up with 8. You spend a whole day in a room. Silly.
It's so interesting because you know Rupert Murdoch, who is my big boss. You know him very well. And I believe that he believes in your way of budgeting, because our budget meetings are the most interesting meetings we have all year. It really comes down to conversation, to sharing, to stretching, to coming in with ideas that can then be expanded and exploited, rather than just coming in and fighting for that sandbag number, or on the other side, fighting for something that really is not going to be achievable and just cause stress.
And that's why you guys are growing. I mean, because people that think that way grow. I mean, Rupert could never sit through a grinded out meeting negotiating. It's not his style.
Absolutely right. In Winning, you talk about 8 aspects of leadership, and they are the aspects that one would expect of a leader. But what do you think about yourself? Do you exhibit all 8 of them? Where do you fall short if you do? I personally don't think you do, but if you think you do. And of the 8, do you have one that you think is the one that's absolutely the most critical, or is it a package?
Well, I think it's a package, but I think you absolutely, to be a great leader, have to energize people. I mean, in the end, you are a lone wolf. And if you're managing a small grocery store with 8 people in your store, you want those 8 people turned on. You want them saying, good morning, Mr. Jones. Good morning, Miss Rogers. Thank you for coming in. You want every touch possible. So you want them to feel ownership and excitement and participate in the fruits of the place. I mean, if you're energized and you can't execute, it isn't any good. But if you had to pick one, I'd want somebody that can excite the room, excite the team, and make them ready to take the hill.
Well, there's no doubt that optimism and that ability to energize really can change the entire tenor of a company and lead that company to become a winning company. In reading Winning, you talk so much about the 20-70-10 rule, which you are famous for. And there are some people who have been critical of your 10, wipe them out. But they have also felt that your 70, that you really have spent a lot of time in your career building the 70. I liken the 70 to the backbone of our business, the backlist of a publishing business, because that's what really keeps us going as we move the backlist, as we make the backlist stronger, and as we sell more copies. Your 70 are people who you feel can move into the 20 to lead the company. Can you talk about how this differentiation makes winners out of everyone?
Yes, because if you take, you know, and the 20-70-10, as I point out in the book, has been called everything from Darwinian to cruel to this and that. What it is, if it's understood, you can't have 20-70-10 without having a company that practices candor and exhibits trust. You can, and one of the things in my first book, where I talked about 20-70-10 briefly, everyone out and did it. And they got all kinds of trouble, lawsuits, everything else. As people said, wait a minute, I'm not in the bottom 10. I'm clearly not in the bottom 10. You know, you told me I've been nice for 25 years. Well, you need a candid appraisal system in place before anyone implements this in any way. But let's take the bottom 10. People say, it's so cruel, you fire them. You don't fire them. You tell them they're going to have to leave within a year. Guess what? 75% of them go anyway. Who wants to hang around a place where you're in the bottom? Nobody likes to feel that way. But nobody's that they might have even wondered if they were. But when they're told they are, they go. And they find better jobs, and they thank you for it. In the middle 70, you always give them bonuses. You always give them not as much as the top 20, but you let them know you care about them. You let them know they're important. You outline their shortcomings and their strengths. Let them improve. And these 20-70-10 designations are not locked in concrete. They are basically a point in time. So that point in time is how you look. But you can move. And somebody in the top 20 can't fall asleep up there and stay there. But you want your top 20 to know you love them. You want to pay them. You want to reward them in every way, in the soul and the wallet. You want to take care of them. And the bottom 10, what people do in businesses and in companies and in orchestras and in schools, schools in particular, I see in the New York City school system, the bad get too much attention. The lousy business, where does the CEO fly to or the manager? They go take care of their problems. And somebody's growing at 15% over here, you leave them alone. Well, maybe they ought to be growing at 30, and you ought to be spending your time there rather than trying to fix the break-even or the small loss business. Same with people. Trying to fix a bad employee is a loss proposition from day one. Part ways, do it fairly, don't humiliate the person, but get on with building great people. Don't hang around with people that aren't delivering or businesses that aren't delivering.
Boy, are you sensible. You make it sound so easy. We all know that it's not so easy. But I must say that in listening to you, in reading Winning, it all seems doable. And it all seems so right in terms of how one deals with people and with problems. When you talk about the top 20 and you talk about they're the stars of the company. And one of the points that you make in Winning that I think is so essential is that if one of your star leaves, replace that star in, I think you say, 8 hours, which I think is absolutely correct. Anyone who has lost a star has known that when you start losing time in replacing that star, everything tends to look dismal. Did you have to replace, did you have to replace many of your top 20 throughout your career?
A couple, and I use a couple in there as examples. Here's what happens when you don't. Everyone knows who the top 20 are. And I think you nailed it very well in your question. When the top 20 leaves, some people start to say, should I be leaving? What's going to happen to the company? Your job as a manager at any level is to say, they left, boom, right in behind them, another top 20. So that there's not a moment's insecurity. They didn't matter. The company goes on the next day as if nothing happened. We've done that right in the transition from myself to my successor. A very good fellow left to become CEO of a big company, Albertsons. I thought, well, this is the book. And he came in the morning to tell us, and at 4 o'clock we announced his replacement, and the next day the replacement was in his chair running the business, and a business that has 30,000 people was not leaderless for a moment.
Any regrets about your career?
You know, I've thought about that 1,000 times, and the answer is no. I mean, I made mistakes. I did some things wrong. I didn't do everything perfect by any stretch of the imagination. But I gave it everything I had. I went at it like a madman every day. I loved it. And could I have done it better? Probably. But I have no regrets about the way I did it.
And winning is fun, both winning your life, the book, and everything else.
It sure is, Jane. Thanks.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. To order additional cassettes or CDs, or to receive a complete catalog of Harper Audio and Cadman titles, please call us at 1-800-331-3761. You might also try our website, www.harperaudio.com. Thank you.